Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. And joining me today is Juliana.
Hello everyone.
And today we're going to be talking about H.G. Wells. War of the Worlds.
Ooh.
The War of the Worlds to give it its full title.
Yes.
Not just any War of the Worlds, the War of the Worlds.
Yes.
And looking back through this, you'd think that, oh, surely Luke has talked about this before.
Every time you say, I'm 100% sure, but then we just talk also.
We also just talk about stuff all the time. And so not all of our conversations about stuff like this are a podcast. And not every mention, put it this way, this book obviously gets mentioned outside of, you know, just episodes about War of the Worlds. I mean, some books will come up and you only ever mention them in the episode where you review them and then they just drop
and
off the face
never
of the world,
again.
Leave your brain and you never think about them and you're like, what was that book?
Yeah.
What was that book? Something by Gareth? Did I ever read a book by Gareth Edwards? Whatever it's going to be, like, here you go. And so this is the opposite of that book. We talk about it, like we think about it all the time and reference it all the time and mention it all the time. And have never done an episode about it. Now, there is one listed here in the SFBRP, you know, episode list.
Yes.
But it was an appearance on another podcast called SFF Audio. And I recently said that, oh, I want to go back through some of these books,
yeah,
do individual episodes about them, and then link to the SFBRP episode about it rather than an appearance on another podcast. So I'm going to separate those out onto a different page.
They get a special list.
Yeah, they'll be in their own list rather than in the general episode list of SFBRP episodes.
Makes sense.
This is going to be it. This is going to be our canonical Let's Just Talk About This One Story, War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
Mm.
Have you read the book before?
Yes.
Yes.
In the past. I don't even know when.
I read it like a month ago.
But it's been a while. But there's certain things that just stick in your head with this book.
So, I mean, my first exposure to this wasn't the book. It was the Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds double album, you know, the concept album.
Yes. It's very good.
Which is very fun. But weirdly enough, we could never find the sides one and two. We only had, so we put sides three and four on. And that's really spooky. I mean, it's like really spooky. And also it's kind of like difficult to know who's who. And in the book, they combine different characters into one character. And so it's a little bit confusing, but you know, that stuff is deeply ingrained.
Yes.
My next exposure to it was probably the 1950s movie, which I think is like set in California, but they have like these, they're not tripods, that they have like these, you know, upside down umbrella-y kind of things and
okay,
heat rays and the black dust is there. Oh man, nightmare fuel when you're like however old you are in that way, and the arm coming, oh, terrible kind of stuff like that. And yeah, so I'd probably been exposed to the War of the Worlds many times, mm-hmm, from, you know, musical versions and movie versions, and then you actually you read it for the first time.
Yes.
And it's kind of different because all of the adaptations, well, not all of the adaptations, but the adaptations, it's really difficult to do a book because it's a very internal book, even though the internal life of the guy, of our main unnamed main character, mm-hmm, isn't very interesting. He's like a writer, and H.G. Wells is a writer who lives in Woking or wherever it is, and H.G. Wells lived in Woking. So, and it's sort of like, you know, going around London, and you know, they go to London, you know. So it's kind of one of these weird things where if you just read the book, you're like, oh, a lot of this is like stuff happening, but there isn't like a through line. There isn't a narrative. Mm. There isn't even one consistent main character, mm-hmm, from the beginning of the story to the end of the story who sees all the stuff happening.
Yeah.
And that's then really difficult for these adaptations to wrestle with, in that it's one guy, but it's not one guy. It's actually like two different guys. It's the writer and then the brother of the writer, neither of which have any names.
Yeah.
And neither of them really do very much, but they observe a lot of stuff.
They are basically the vessels.
Yeah, they are the vessels.
For the exciting thing that happens around them.
And so you get the Steven Spielberg, Tom Cruise version of it.
And that's actually the first time I had been exposed to the War of the Worlds.
Yes.
Like that came before I read the book for the first time.
And they do something similar. Well, not similar. They do something interesting in that they do have a lot of the same story beats and a lot of the same stuff. But it's sort of like they make it so if Tom Cruise sees it happen, you see it happen. So, but if something happens like just over a hill and Tom Cruise doesn't see it happen, you just see like the light show and the other stuff. And
you see the outcome.
Yeah, which then means the one guy has to be, you know, there when it starts, move over here. Here, and then get over there for the adventurous stuff, and then get over there and be stuck in a basement with Tim Robbins.
So scary.
And then get over there. And in the book, you're like, oh, that's actually like two different things. So we see that there's one person who like literally sees the he's got a friend who's an astronomer and he sees the flares coming from Mars, and then they land like on his house. Well, not on his house, but like, you know, in the park,
in the field,
in the common, Horschel Common or whatever is next to his house. And then so he has like this little, you know, southeast London kind of adventure.
Yeah.
And then is stuck underground for a week. Meanwhile, his brother does something in the rest of London that gets to see, you know, like the evacuation and the panic and the evacuation of London and go out and see the Thunder Child out, you know, on the, wherever it is, in the Thames Estuary or wherever it is there. Like
in the dunes or something.
And then the action comes back and then you get the deserted London look around, you know, which again, that like one person walking around a deserted city, just that is like super influential in science fiction and movies and everything, sort of like one person walking around a city and it's deserted, you know.
Yes,
you get that in The Day of the Triffids, you get it in
28 Days Later,
which is just an adaptation of Day of the Triffids, you know. But I'm just saying it's sort of like that is a common theme as well.
Yes.
Of one person walking around a deserted city, and it's like super spooky because this should be the busiest, most populated city on earth.
And even in the time when he wrote the book, I don't know what, 18 something.
Well, let's have a look here. It was first published in 1889.
Yeah, I thought 1889, 90. So even at that time, some in this kind of era, there might have been cities that felt less busy. But London,
no,
obviously,
London was
London was,
and that
crazy.
Is the entire point. And here's another thing, which is when you read the book, you're like, oh, this was not a worldwide invasion.
Yeah,
like it's not like the Earth is being invaded by aliens.
Not like Independence Day.
It's not like Independence Day when New York gets a big dish
and Paris and
Paris, you know,
everywhere they station all over the world.
Yeah, every major capital city. No, it isn't. It's like just this like one bit of London. They all landing in this one bit of London, which goes, you go, oh right, this is very, very specifically a London book rather than it's not a worldwide invasion. It is London, which is the capital city of the British Empire, is specifically being targeted. And my read on this is that, you know, the aliens have kind of like sent probes out and they're like, look, if we can just decapitate the head of this worldwide, sprawling, tentacle sprawling
The British Empire was an invasion
I'm just saying
of the world.
It was
well.
The most powerful thing. So like, obviously London being the capital city of the greatest empire at the time, you know, the sun never sits on the British Empire, all that kind of thing. They're like, if we can just get that, chop the top of that head off, that's the main bad stuff, you know.
The main culprit gone.
That's the main enemy gone. And so yes, London was specifically targeted. So when you in the book, it's very clear that people are fleeing London and going north, and other people are trying to get across the channel because it's safe over there, because that's not where the aliens are, that's not where the Martians are. And I really like that, how focused it is.
Yes.
And so many adaptations make it feel like, oh, this is, you know, worldwide, or it's just happening in LA or whatever it is. But and it can be transposed to different places.
Yeah.
But no, I really enjoy the fact that it's very, very targeted on, of course, London, but then also in the places where, you know, H.G. Wells lived.
Yeah, and, I mean, tell the stories of the places you know best.
Yes, it's right what you know. And if you know London, that kind of stuff. So rereading it again this time, which is me rereading it for the manyth time, like
uncountable times.
Uncountable. Yeah. And yeah. even since I started the SFBRP, started this podcast 18 and a half years ago, mm-hmm. I read it multiple times since, again, for the SFF audio podcast. But also, I once had a creative writing, like a novel writing exercise, which is to write it. Like rewrite it, but from the point of view of one of the Martians.
Okay.
But again, grappling with the idea of like, wait a second, they always try and have one character. You mm-hmm. always want to tell a story and have one through character mm-hmm. and not just be an observer, but be part of the action. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, I can just like, he never mentions which one of which alien is which. You know,
yeah.
So I'll just make it that one of the aliens that comes down is our viewpoint character.
Okay.
And he can be, because, you know, they have these, you know, walking machines and
yes.
flying machines
yes.
and other things. He can be in these all these different places and be the viewpoint character.
Okay.
And yeah, it was a fun idea. Maybe I'll talk about it later in the podcast. It's not that important, but it's a fun, like I had a lot of fun working out all of the different scenes and how they're connected and what the motivations would be behind the aliens and how they would communicate over long distances
yeah.
and how the mechanics works. And there's also in the book, it's mentioned that the aliens bring with them like another life form, like a more human shaped life form,
mm-hmm.
which they use to drink their blood, you know, as food on the way. Like H.G. Wells is very explicit about this. Sort of like, yeah, they brought some food with them, but that only lasted them the journey over
yeah,
and now they
and
need
they're
more stuff. And the idea being that like those, you know, that our character starts as one of those, and then the each time that you ingested the memories of that person or like of that being is mm. uploaded into the brain, the big head of the thing. So it's like this idea of identity being passed up into something,
right.
And one like the big entity being controlled by like smaller and smaller things, if
yeah.
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So in our world, we've got like the whole or the world or the nation, and then back down there, there's like a smaller group which is controlling that, and then that smaller group which is controlling that, and then with vehicles and stuff, like you have a plane flying, and there's one
yeah.
person controlling it.
Yeah.
But then that their brain is controlling their body, and then inside. So I wanted to go deeper layers
yeah.
into it as
and
well.
And I think this book, The War of the Worlds, actually makes that quite possible because of the kind of the storytelling
yeah.
and the way that it shows the different aspects of the invasion. You know,
yeah.
it's like you can just switch it around and look
yeah.
at it from the other side.
No, but also this, what I'm saying here, which is like sort of one, like a being
yeah.
controlling a bigger being, controlling
yeah.
a bigger being
yeah.
is in the, it's in
yeah,
the text,
that's what
of, it's in the text
yeah.
Of the War of the Worlds
yeah.
because they said that like the tripods and the, you know, the machines that they're using are like really fluid and beautiful, and
yeah.
like the mechanics are really great and they're really flowing. And then the aliens, like the Martians themselves, are like these gribbly things that can't move very much, and like they're weighed down by the stronger gravity and are really struggling. And I'm like, oh, that's what humans are like. You know, you put a human in a car and they're free and they're feeling it, and you know, you feel the road. You're not even like you don't think, I'm going to turn the steering wheel this way to get over there. You're just connected one-to-one
yeah.
with the thing,
yeah.
which is going faster than you, which is bigger than you, which is, you know, and yeah, and it keeps going back into it, you know,
yes.
keeps going deeper and deeper in. And I wanted to take it one extra layer deep in that the beings that the Martians are drinking the bloods of, they are drinking the blood, but part of that is actually they are absorbing the memories and the personalities of the thing that are going in. And so when they start doing that with the humans, that's when they start being like susceptible to the human germs and the human
bacteria
and viruses
and stuff,
and stuff
yeah,
like
yeah.
that. They thought they had it, but they didn't realize that, you know, again, it was just a fun little twist on the end of the book. But
yeah.
again, so I'm saying I've read this book many times and I've got very deep into lots of the scenes of this and lots of the motivations
yeah.
and lots of the ideas of this.
So also by not only reading it, but also thinking about it more in depth
yes.
by creating your own story. And
yeah.
like if you're writing your own story of something, you have to be more complex. Like you have to think about the things surrounding it, and like the ideas. Why would anybody do it? Or
what's going on here and stuff.
And so
it doesn't all have to make sense, though. Like,
no,
it's
no,
fine.
Of course not. Of course
the
not.
The world doesn't
but
make sense.
But if you are just reading a book, you're more like a passive.
Yeah, you're just enjoying it. But that's
you're also a vessel. Like you're just taking it in.
But that's the thing. The first few times I read it, I was just like that. And even now, this last time, I was just reading it, going, "Oh yeah, this is fun. Oh, I remember this. Oh, I remember that." You know.
Yeah.
But it is, again, it is a very tricky book, like I say, not just to adapt, but also it's a tricky book to think about because again, you've got a character who isn't named, so you're just thinking, well, this is just H.G. Wells, but then his brother turns up and he's got different personalities, and then the main character like changes his personality, suddenly switches. Sometimes he's like writing really beautiful stuff and you're like, okay, so this is written in the like the past tense, I did this, I did that, and then he sort of like has, you know, in the end of the book he like breaks down and is like, oh, I'm just gonna go crazy, I'm gonna kill myself, you know, it's sort of like has despair. And you're like, oh, so he's like often switching between very calculating, very analytical to super emotional states within the book.
Yeah.
And again, it does it when you're reading that, you're like, oh, that doesn't make sense. But I think it's like this, and it's weird to say this, but like the character of our main character, you know, like our unnamed narrator is as it needs to be. But not as it needs to be. What am I trying to say? It's more like it feels like panic. You know, it feels like someone grappling with panic. It feels like someone grappling with post-traumatic stress disorder.
I was just about to say that. It sounds very much like a person with PTSD and the different ways that is showing itself.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because in 1889, I don't think that concept was quite as vivid.
No, because the truth is it was written as a serial and just like from one chapter to the next.
Yes.
It's fine if the character changes. Yeah. Like, oh, this is like an action
so
section.
So it came out in like a magazine. Like, right?
It said here. I guess I'll just go down to publication. Pearson's magazine from April 1897 to December 1897.
So it was like a serial.
Yeah, so it was a serial published. And so that's the thing. It does feel like in this chapter we're doing fun action stuff so our main character can have his wits about him and do this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And in this one we're going to do sort of like weird horror stuff.
Yes.
And so he's like traumatized by things and he's all like, oh no, I can't do this. Yeah. And in this one we're going to do like other kind of, you know, like this is now mystery. And
exploration of different genres.
And now this is an exploration of like the science of this. And now because he's a writer, he has scientist friends and he's got connections here so he can now write about the science stuff, and it's sort of very much, you know, in that style. So I think that's another issue with the book. But again, it you can like explain it away, or he's got PTSD, or he's like his character changes, or what would you be like in a massive. But also, it is just a serial book, but these bones of it actually create a richness to it, like because there is so many of these different ideas, like so many of these really fun turns of phrase, these like amazing descriptions of things. It stands side by side with like, oh, that plotting doesn't make very much sense. And wait, what's this character doing? Like, it's like a totally different character. Oh, it is a different character. Oh, this is the brother, you know, like that.
Yes.
So it's weird that this serialized style of writing and like writing for what this scene needs right now.
Yeah.
Because the person last read the last chapter a month ago.
Yeah.
And is going to read the next chapter in another month. Mm-hmm. It's like very, I don't know, that serialized nature. It is very like 1889 or 1887.
And so when they put it together into a book, H.G. Wells didn't then like write it into a novel, but they just literally just
whenever you do these fix-up novels, you change a bit here and there to work out some bits and pieces. I don't know how much it was rewritten after it was first published, but it does work as a novel.
Okay,
but it is just like it's not a modern novel. So if you just sit down and go like, oh, here's this famous science fiction book, let's just read it. What is it like? It's not like these books. It's not like modern books. It's not like what we have now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is very different.
How is the language? Like, do you, is it difficult? Is it like really like flowery and like...
It's not flowery, but it does have
Victorian.
Yes, it does have those long Victorian sentences, but it is well written. Like, H.G. Wells was a very good writer. Mm-hmm. And the lines that he has and the characters who turn up and, you know, say these lines... it's still very good. You know, okay. just like those opening lines. Who would have believed in the closing years of the 20th century, minds incalculable, like more advanced than ours, of examining us like we were bacteria in a drop of, you know, water. Or like whatever
it
is.
Yeah.
It's like all of that kind of stuff is really good.
Yeah.
Like, and also really does cast a long shadow over a lot of science fiction and a lot of like 20th century all the way through to the current day of how we think about like viewpoints and again, I'm not saying he was influential. I'm just saying it's
built on the shoulders.
Yes, I mean, of course, lots of other people are writing, but I was for this SFBRP Must Reads project that I'm doing, I was like, oh, let's go back and read some Jules Verne, From the Earth to the Moon, which is from 1865.
Yeah.
And it feels like it. I mean, of course, it's in translation and it's doing a different thing, but it's very much like the form of what a novel is still being like hashed out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what is it that a novel is doing? And From the Earth to the Moon is like, I am telling you a story, and it's like somebody reporting on a story that has happened. And what makes a novel so good is that you can really get into that internal journey of someone. Like, okay, let's focus on this one person.
Yeah.
What is their story? How are they a different character at the end of the story than the start of the story? And the, you know, From the Earth to the Moon is very much like, all right, there was these people who have a gun club and they wanted to shoot a big gun. What's the biggest target? The moon. Right, let's go. Yeah. And From the Earth to the Moon is like this fun satire about, like, you know, Americans are... It's pretty much sort of like, Americans never saw a problem that couldn't be solved by shooting it. So let's, you know... And it's really, like, it's really fun satire in that way.
That hasn't changed,
but
has it?
But the From the Earth to the Moon, the Jules Verne kind of satire is like satire on its face. It's like going, right, let's just make fun of the Americans and the Germans and the British and the French, and, you know, I'm French, but it's like, that's all good. But what H.G. Wells is doing here is he is then embedding this satire, or let's say political commentary or world commentary, into a story like three levels deep.
Yeah,
you know, because it isn't just going, hey, let's make jokes about Americans wanting to shoot things. It's much more like, right, I want to talk about, like, in the end, the book is about the colonialism of the British Empire and, you know, wiping out, I think it said on Wikipedia that I just looked at before, it was like the Tasmanian Aboriginals who were just like wiped out, you know, the Brits come in, disease, just
they spread the germs.
Yeah, it's not just that, it's also like just wiping out Aboriginal populations, like intentionally, unintentionally, just go, well, all of these people should be Christians and
ignorance and missionaries
or whatever be. No, I'm not just saying it's like ignorant missionaries, I'm just saying the whole system didn't consider the lives of those local people worth didn't consider them worth consideration. What am I trying to say? Like, the value of them was so much lower than what any other utility that the land...
cultured people and you are uncultured.
Just below notice.
Yes.
And he's sort of like, well, this was an opportunity to critique that. And the same kind of thing, like he was, you know, in the time machine, he's critiquing different class structures and like, if we keep these class structures going into the future, what would it be like? Mm-hmm. And here it's sort of like, what would it be like if London was invaded by a power which is above, like the British Navy turning up in, you know, Tasmania. Mm-hmm. What would that feel like if something just as deep? But that is three levels below, because first of all, it's, you know, a fun alien invasion. Yeah. Second, it's like this, you know, horror and psychological and like this person's journey and what it's going through. Mm. And then once you get past, hey, this is a fun alien invasion story or an invasion story, or whatever it is, underneath all of that is sort of like, and now we can talk politics, and now we can critique empire, and now we can critique colonialism. And so it feels like a proper novel about something, even though at the face of it, like every adaptation is like, wouldn't it be scary if aliens invade? And yeah. It's like, yes, it would be really scary if aliens invaded. And underneath that scariness, like another two layers down, we can talk politics and we can talk, you know, commentary, and we can do the satire. Like, it can be properly satirical.
Yeah. Now, here I have another question. You
underneath,
mentioned
yeah.
you mentioned the contemporary storytelling, and you mentioned Jules Verne. Do you feel like when you read Adrian Tchaikovsky and the satirical books by that what's yeah. his name Parker, that you know the 15 Ways to Invade a City?
Oh right, yes, yeah, yeah.
These kind of writers get across something that really rings true to you as a British person who has spent, you know, your youth yeah. and time in. So there's this certain satirical humor of yeah. British people.
Well, yeah, just rereading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Like, that is 100% there.
And do you think, like, do you feel that even if H.G. Wells wrote this in 1889.
Saying, yeah.
Do you still feel there is like a bridge or like an ancestral connection
there is,
to
but
that?
But H.G. Wells isn't writing satire.
No. He isn't writing satire.
Yeah.
But he is writing from a very British perspective.
Yeah.
Like, is the kind of, you know, there's this certain way of saying things
yeah.
in English,
yes,
where you know, where there's like, yes, we could do that.
Right.
Doesn't particularly mean
it's going to happen. In
yes.
fact, saying we could do that means we are absolutely not doing that. There's
exactly.
no chance
this
that's
kind of stuff.
Happen.
Do you feel that trickle through like that?
Yes,
is
but
it,
I don't think H.G. Wells is part of that. There's a whole other side of satirical and comedy writing,
mm-hmm.
which is influencing, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide and Ian M. Banks and Adrian Tchaikovsky, which H.G. Wells really isn't. He's not in that lineage.
Okay, let's take away the satirical writing style.
Okay,
but just the
comedy. Like H.G. Wells, this is not a funny book.
No,
there
no,
are
it
moments
isn't.
Which are funny in it.
Yes, but what I'm saying is more the mannerisms of the
no. It's nope. just it's just different. Like again,
okay,
it's the Victorian style of this,
yes,
which is like he's going for like, you know, in parts Gothic horror adventure story pulp,
yeah.
you know what we think is a pulpy kind of stuff. No, it is a different. I think it is a different science fiction tradition in
mm-hmm.
that way.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't think like the through if you were going to tie it back. But again, of course, it's all some of it's the influence there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with H.G. Wells with these, you know, with the time machines and War of the Worlds, it's much more like this. These establish some like main rules of science fiction as a whole.
Okay.
And that is like different from like a stylistic thing of like, oh, let's use science fiction for the purposes of satire or comedy.
Yeah.
And that's a different kind of thing.
Okay.
Because I think War of the Worlds, it's sort of like it's sure, I mean, Wikipedia, there's some very opinionated stuff here. It's sort of like antecedents, what was it said here?
Please say slowly, what?
Influences.
Yes.
It says here, a popular misconception is that War of the Worlds is the first alien invasion story and that H.G. Wells is the father of the alien invasion genre. And I'm like, that is such a straw man argument. It's sort of like, it is a popular misconception. It's sort of like, by who? Like, of course, maybe there is in fact, actually, I can't even see. There's not even a list here. You know, there isn't a thing, you know.
No link to any sort of truth to that statement.
There is not even a link to someone who says War of the Worlds is the first alien invasion story and H.G. Wells is the father of the alien invasion genre.
Yeah.
There's not even a link to a claim. It's sort of saying a popular misconception is that. And so, like, I don't think anyone thinks that this is the first ever story about an alien coming to Earth and invading or whatever. But the point is that this set the rules. This set the tone.
Mm.
This is the reason why all of these science fiction stories about alien invasions like have a kind of like have this a similar vibe that Earth is going around like that. Life on Earth is continuing like normal. And then something turns up which is overwhelmingly more powerful
mm-hmm.
and is
technologically advanced.
Technologically advanced and
yep.
invading for an unknown reason. And it doesn't even matter what the reason is, but they are bent on death and destruction.
Mm.
So it's that, you know, war plus horror plus science fiction little stuff, mm-hmm. you know, putting all that together.
Leading to apocalyptic kind of states.
Leading to apocalyptic kind of stuff, and that maybe some plucky humans will be able to fight back, or keep going long enough and the tide will turn for some reason and have, you know, desolated, you know, destroyed areas, but some triumph for humans at the end. And sure, other people might have done invasions, other people might have done aliens, other people, but like that formula is now like it's still the formula of so many of these things.
That's,
you know,
true. So basically the equivalent of the laws of robotics by Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, kind of like in the same way that Asimov has sort of like invented the word robotics, you know, like that people say Martians are invading, you know, stuff coming, you know, all of that kind of stuff is based in like this, that like the world that H.G. Wells created with War of the Worlds. And yeah, like alien invasion, Martian invasion, Martians, just the word Martians and things is, it's, yeah, and that's what, then you have some other mealy mouth Wikipedia spec. Despite all of this, War of the Worlds has vastly overshadowed its two predecessors in both influence and popularity, marking the alien invasion genre a household name in science fiction. It's like, yeah, no shit. Like, you just don't have the, like, there just isn't anything that stands in the same way of, like, one person pretty much coming up and setting the template for, like, almost every alien invasion book and comic and movie and radio adaptation and almost every other form of media that comes afterwards is like other science fiction authors like going, right, so I'm going to do alien invasion. I'm going to do a War of the Worlds, but what's my thing? All right. You know, and Peter F. Hamilton is like, all right, there's going to be portals and there's going to be this and there's going to be, you know, or whatever it's going to, you know, whatever it's going to be.
So it's a little bit of a mix between survivor bias, because if there have been other people writing similar things, they haven't survived.
No, it's not that they haven't survived. It's like, compared to War of the Worlds, just kind of irrelevant. And, I'm not saying that they could be better stories. Mm. They could be better books. Mm-hmm. Like, if those had gained popularity beforehand or whatever, like, sure, it would be that way. But, like, War of the Worlds, not, again, it's like, I know it's weird to say this, but it's like Shakespeare. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you're going to go, like, in 500 years' time, people are still going to be singing the Jeff Wayne song and still going to be referencing whatever. I mean, maybe not, but it's going to be hundreds of years before this book drops out. And I think a lot of the other books on, like, the science fiction that we reviewed here and that on the SFBRP must reads list, I'd say probably 3 or 4 other books might still be being read in 50 years time, let alone 200 years time. And while War of the Worlds, the novel, might not still be being read as much, I still think the format that it came up with, like the ideas that it came up with, like the story structure and like the city, like the empty city devastated by aliens and one person walking around in it. Again, empty cities have been done before. You've got like the plague ones and these other ones, but like, you know, walking, like in the almost every single science fiction movie which has got any alien invasions, they come out of the bunker at the end and walk around and there's destruction here and destruction there. And it's sort
but
of like
something
this,
survived.
Yeah, this, the humans walking around this the remnants of an alien destruction is like, it's just part of the it's just part of the language of cinema and science fiction.
Yeah. That's actually, this kind of stuff is also happening in like music. And I'm thinking like very much like when Mozart was living, he wasn't like, of course he was successful and stuff, but they were like Salieri was so much bigger than Mozart. And now, from our perspective, Mozart is the thing.
Yeah, Salieri is just the other.
He's like the pop star.
Yeah, but he's like the other character in the Amadeus movie. If you know what I mean, like that's he's now supporting character.
He is now supporting character, but at the time when they were living, Salieri was so much bigger. And the same with Bach, like that. Now we have like so many things by Johann Sebastian Bach was also largely disappeared, forgotten, and not not whatever.
And then rediscovered,
and then
Mendelssohn,
he rediscovered things, and suddenly it was like a big hype, and like Bach was just a church musician. Like he was not like big, well-known with cello suite and played all over the world and stuff. So it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, but this is the thing. When it comes down to like a big movie, like Independence Day, and you're like, oh, we're still doing the upload
that
the virus.
So H.G. Wells.
And again, very knowingly by whoever it is, Roland Emmerich or whatever, they're going, well, let's just do, like, what would the War of the Worlds be like now? Right, we need overwhelming force, but our weapons are so good. Well, we're going to have shields, and we're going to have, exoskeletons.
Yes.
That's another idea of like, oh, so the aliens inside the exoskeleton, but then the exoskeleton's inside the small spaceship, and then the small shape goes inside the bigger spaceship, and then the bigger spaceship goes inside the even bigger spaceship.
Yeah,
you know.
Like, what's these called? The Russian dolls.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly
and
it.
And that goes, like I say, all the way back to H.G. Wells' War of the World. It's like, this thing inside, this thing inside, this thing inside, this thing, and then the actual enemy, whatever it is. So,
I mean, it's absolutely true with us as well. Like, we are, we think of ourselves as thinking, moving things. Yeah. But in the end, we are very much puppeteered by hormones and bacteria living inside us.
Don't look too deep, because you're like, no, free will just doesn't exist, does it? You're like, shh, don't say that.
Yes.
We're all agreeing. We're all agreeing to pretend that free will exists.
Yes. Let's make sure we don't get mad.
Yeah. So what else do I want to say about this? I had a lot of fun reading it, because, again, there's so many really fun scenes and fun stuff happening. And also, it's fun now with Google Maps, where you can just go, wait, where's this? And you can just type it in and go, oh, right, he's gone there. I'm sure there's maps of where the different characters go around, and then
what
he goes,
happens where
he goes across to Richmond and walks up through Richmond Park, and you're like, oh, I've been there. Like, because it's so grounded in where it was. I mean, he obviously had a lot of fun like destroying his neighbor's house or whatever.
It's a bit like in the Great North Road, where you know, oh, this is the bridge. I know this bridge.
Yeah. And we visited some of the places, and again, that was, I think, Peter F. Hamilton in the book Great North Road, like doing a similar thing of like, well, I've got to base it in like everyday life, or like of what's going on here. And so he ties it to bits of geography, like, oh, he went to university there, so he can have, like,
and this makes everything so approachable.
Yeah. It makes a big difference. Honestly, it does, to go like, oh, yeah, I can picture London in, 1897, and
I thought it's 1889.
Look, what does it say here? I've already, 1898.
1898. Okay.
1898. So, it even says it in the opening lines, right at the end of
the millennial.
Who would have believed? Well, can I just open it here? Read online now. Yeah, we can just see it here. This is the Project Gutenberg, says no one would believe that in the last years of the 19th century. So that's what it would. What does it say? Slowly and surely they drew their plans against us. And you're like, holy shit, this is fun writing.
Epic.
So yeah, there's it seems so safe and tranquil. End of chapter. You're like, ooh, next chapter. And then came the Night of the Falling Star. So it takes a while to get like into like who this character is. And then again, never names them. And then for a third of the book, just goes off and like has an adventure, like see what his brother's doing. It's all like, meanwhile, my brother was over here and he was having trouble getting out of London.
Yes.
And I think that's probably the weakest part of the book, is where it actually switches over to the brother's point of view. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of needed to get like the whole setup of like, why is London deserted?
Yeah.
But I could see a better version of this, which would be like, just follow his wife. Or something like, just imagine his, like, he sent his wife away, but sent his wife away in the other direction. And you could follow on, there would be a way to tell this story, which is a little bit more connected to like, because I think you actually need someone who's more different to him than his brother, which is just sort of like another guy without a name, who's like just the same guy going on a slightly different adventure.
Yes.
It could have been
so
a bit better.
This part then feels, when you say, you have one person in the action
yeah.
locally, and then somebody outside of it. That really reminds me of the stories of, you know, Second World War children are being sent out to the country.
This was way before this, yeah.
But these, the same, like human behavior in catastrophe situations, it doesn't matter where or when, will always act quite similarly.
Yeah. Yeah, this whole section here in London. My younger brother was in London, and then it just carries on. It's sort of like, oh, now we're over there with him. So like a lot of stuff here. Exodus from London, The Thunder Child. And then book two. So there's actually two different books. There's, you know, The Coming of the Martians and The Earth Under the Martians. And what I think is that one of the real strengths of this book is that whole section of just hanging out in a hole, like being very quiet as an alien. Like you're in a crater where aliens have, and they're working and they're exploring, and there's you and another person slowly going mad, like fighting each other in slow motion in silence, not to be killed, but like fighting over an eye hole to see out of the eye. And it's just really good in a way that like wouldn't modern novel spend time to just be like, right, this guy is just going to be in a hole for like 2 weeks sitting in a hole watching some aliens slowly going crazy and not quite understanding what's happening.
Yeah.
But he is now a world, of course, this is written from the point of view who's now someone who's a world expert on the Martians, because he's the guy who sat in a hole and watched the Martians
for two weeks. Yeah.
And it's so fun and so creepy. And it's like, again, it's so weird. You'll be like, it's sort of like, wait, is there still the same novel as the adventure story that we were just reading? Yes, it is. And it is, again, I just really enjoy that kind of stuff. And
And nowadays, probably the editor would say, nah, this you don't need this. This is...
I mean, there just wouldn't have been an editor. It's sort of like, this is how novels were written. Somebody write a novel. There wasn't the whole, like, you know, focus groups and promotion and stuff like that.
Can this be sold?
Yeah, whatever. Like, and it's just sort of like, yeah, going enough. I'm just going to say, I really enjoy it. And again, not a perfect book. I'm not going to give it 4 stars, but I think it's just, I think it's really good. Again, when we're looking back on these SFBRP must read sort of like, the book has to be rated high. I'm going to give this 4.5 stars.
Yeah.
Off this kind of reading.
Yeah.
But again, it is a book that I have read many times.
Yes.
For many different reasons, and also have absorbed the story many times in many different adaptations, either explicit adaptations or like sideways adaptations and other retellings, you know.
Yeah.
It's got to the point where it is a fairy tale, if you know what I mean. Once upon a time, and you're like, oh, we're just going to do, you know, a Brothers Grimm kind of thing.
Yes.
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's sort of like, all right, we know the rules here. Sort of like, who would have believed in the closing?
Yeah,
like,
the rebels. Okay. Yeah.
And slowly and surely they drew their plans against us. You're like, oh, alien invasion. Let's go. You know.
And one thing I really want to point out here as well, this is one of the most accessible books because it is now in public domain. You don't have to pay for it. It's all available Project Gutenberg, and it's probably, you can find it in bookstores.
Any book from like before 1940 is like that now.
But that's really great.
Yeah, it's been continuously in print since 1898. So
and that's quite a feat.
So, all right, so what do you think? Anything else that we need to add to our official SFBRP episode about the War of the Worlds? Again, I've just been generally enthusiasing about it.
Yes.
Enthusing on it.
I think that's good. I don't think like going into any details would bring any more...
Yeah. Talk about H.G. Wells and his politics, which were like, you know, fine, whatever. But again, it's sort of like you're judging a book. Like, again, now we're judging a book which is 128 years old.
Yes.
And I still think it should be... I think it still should be judged, should still be talked about, should still be thought about.
Yeah.
Because... What is it? One of those things where it was like the entirety, what was the quote? The entirety of the science fiction world is just a footnote to the works of H.G. Wells or whatever it is. Like, he did so much with this book and The Time Machine and all these other stuff. Yeah. I think probably the Time Machine and War of the Worlds are the two strongest ones. And I reread both, and both of them were already on the SFBRP must-reads list and they're staying on there. So,
absolutely. I think they have their spot on there secured.
Yes, that's it. All right. More episodes coming in the future. I've reread quite a few books to check if they would either be on or not be on the SFBRP must-reads list. But I'm going to save all of that discussion for its own episode where we'll go through all of the books that I've reread in the last year since we started the SFBRP must-reads project.
What's this current episode's number?
This will be episode, I think, 591. Actually, I could probably just look.
Okay, so we're approaching another milestone.
Episode 550 was the start of the SFBRP must-reads project.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, wrap it up before we get to 600.
Okay.
So there's a few books that I still want to get to.
Yeah.
I've just been reading, currently in the middle of The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. So they might get another episode about them.
Yeah.
But probably won't do an episode about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy until you read it for the first time.
Yeah.
So three other books that I want to get to, which is China Mountain Zhang by Maureen F. McHugh.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no audiobook version, so I actually have to, use my eyes.
You have to eyes and read.
And so that one, and then C.J. Cherry's Finity's End, which we've got as a paper book, but it isn't available as audiobooks and it's not available as ebooks. So I don't think that holds up to the must reads thing, which is which books are the best examples of science fiction available to read today. Mm. If they're no longer in print, there's no ebook or audiobook version.
It's difficult to get.
The only ones you can do is get secondhand bookshop special orders.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it can be on the SFBRP must reads list.
It's like the opposite of The War of the Worlds
being in
public domain.
And it is probably just a nostalgia pick from Luke's reading, getting into science fiction in 1993 or whatever it was. So I will reread it, but I'm doubting it'll get onto the SFBRP must reads list. But either way, a few books which we've got to make final decisions on, like is 2001 A Space Odyssey getting on the list by Arthur C. Clarke? That's a question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll in a few episodes time, once I've finished reading like three more books, we'll do and done episodes on those books or not, we'll wrap up the SFBRP must reads list project.
Cool.
Talk about some of the books that have been added, been removed, read, but haven't had their own episodes, and we'll wrap that up soon. All right, that's it from us. You can follow us on Instagram. I'm Luke Burridge. Juliana is JUKU Berlin.
Yeah.
And you can become our friends on Goodreads and suggest books that you would like to see us review. If you check out the Goodreads SFBRP listener group.
There's a group give us discussion. Feedback. There's a feedback thread.
Feedback
all kinds of things.
Book recommendation thread. Email me luke@juggler.net for any reason at all. We're on Mastodon, I guess, whatever. Don't really post very much there. On Blue Sky. If you follow me on Blue Sky, and I'll follow you back, and because I'm enjoying Blue Sky as a way into other science fiction book criticism and stuff. So
interesting.
That's a fun little sphere over there. And finally, Patreon. So if you enjoy this podcast, you can support us financially.
Yeah.
Pay for books for us to read. pay us to read so we can spend money on books. Go to patreon.com/Luke Burridge. A lot of juggling stuff there. But, thank you very much to our SFBRP listeners who support us
on
Patreon. So that's it from us. Thanks a lot for listening. And we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.